Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy Orthodox Christmas.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it is
Orthodox
Christmas.
Oh. Oh, okay. I only know one Christmas. Okay, I hope everybody had a great break. And homework one will be posted today after I get out of this room. What? You didn't expect there be homework in this term?
No.
Well, there is no interviews.
That's what
well. But there will be homework. And just think about it. The third homework will be sort of exploration. You know that we're in the second half, so we'll just set you free to watch some talk and read some paper and write something. And the only decision is that do you really want to get this course done within this 3 weeks? Which means the homework three will do the Friday when the course ends, and we'll talk about what you guys discover. Oh, it is going to be slightly longer than your homework because you're going to read something that haven't been covered in the course, which hence explore. So we could move that tutorial to the next week. So there's something you can think about it, and now we'll do a poll, and hopefully it's not completely 50-50 split so that we can pick a time. But if it's 50-50, I have no idea. So let's get started. So the course title is Cosmology, and it will be an introductory course. So it will assume you have never taken a cosmology course. So if you have, you will find the course is hopefully a review, like the things that you know. But that will be my assumption. And okay, motivation. I really don't know how to motivate about learning about the universe. And then Dan says, well, I think the definition of a human being are the creatures intelligent enough to wonder about the universe. So I guess that would be our motivation because we are very curious about the entire universe. The ultimate curiosity that we have not been satisfied. And hence, our main part about the standard model of cosmology that we think we know what's going on will end about in 2 weeks. And then we'll talk about some speculations, some major speculations called inflation that the majority of the people used to think that's what happened. But you know, now people are trying to think, well, what about alternatives? Because it's definitely not something we're sure about. Okay, so the outline of the course is that we'll spend about 3 lectures to build the fundamentals, which is really exciting. I'm gonna write down the metric and equation of motion for the universe. So that's just that, it's like F equals ma, and the metric of the universe. This is number of lectures planned. It could change. And then I think that I consider myself is teaching a history course. It's just the history of the universe for 14 billion years, but nevertheless, it's a history course. So I think there are only two orders are natural for a history course. You either go with the time, called the chronological, or you go against the time, which is called anti-chronological. So I really like to teach a course chronologically what happens in the universe. But as I mentioned before, nobody knows what happens at the beginning of the universe. Actually, nobody really knows if there is a beginning of the universe. So we'll just do the reverse way. We'll start with present or even in the future. and then go backwards. And then as we go backwards to about 1 second, or maybe 10 to the minus 10 second, we begin to speculate because we don't know what's going on. That's just the hard truth, which is why it's exciting. It's not something, everything we taught, we are going to talk about this course, as we know, is something we begin to doubt about our theories. Okay, so if we go in the reverse time order, how can I draw a really long time? Okay, let's try. If I have this many boards, it must be possible. Oh, no, stay here, otherwise I can't reach it. Okay. So this is about, present. So the course will first start to talk about things basically happening now or in a slightly future, which is the dark energy. Something we have no idea what it is, but let's just take it to be a cosmology constant. It's something we have no idea. And it's a constant that Einstein added into his equation. It happened to be measured quite well. So although we have no idea what's the mechanism such a constant exists, but we do know it's probably a constant, and we know its value pretty darn well. So it's very interesting, and that is what is probably going to dominate in our future, and if it doesn't vary. So that's what we're going to start our course with. And then, we go backward in time, as we say. Now we come to the present, and we have us. I'll leave this to the people who study social science to talk about. And then if you go backwards, then there's dinosaurs dominating the Earth. That's a very interesting topic, but I'm not an expert in dinosaurs. But then we can keep going. Then our next topic would be structure formation, which was a very basic view of, for example, we imagine there is a ball, and the density of the ball is slightly larger than its surroundings. And then we wonder how this slightly larger of density is going to evolve. And then it will give us some insight of like how big, large structure in the universe, which we will mention soon, has been formed. And then if we continue going back in time, it's sort of paralleling, is the very famous cosmic macro background. Okay. Yeah, I know. That's the problem, that I mentioned CMB way too many times. I have no idea how to spell it anymore. Okay. So this is something is basically what we have been measured for decades. And our measurement on this has been more and more precise. And actually the world leading expert for how to analyze the data on this is Kendrick, who is going to teach you the cosmology exploration course. So we'll give you some basic introduction of how this is formed, what has been measured, and why that measuring this is very important. But he will actually tell you that how do your theory will predict something and how to connect it to what is being predicted and all those fun stuff. So this is really our major observations using gigantic, very expensive satellites. And then that will distinguish, that will tell us something. Remember all those things that I keep saying that we have no idea about? And these are the observations that hopefully will shed some insights on that. We'll rule out some models. It's still unclear that it will make a decisive decision on which models are correct, but that's the experiments we're doing in cosmology. And then we keep going. This is some, thick bun. I know how to spell that. Then there is nucleosynthesis. Ah. I give up. Okay, I must have spelled it wrong. But this is something that we know pretty well, and where there's some small problem. But in a large sense, we know pretty well, and this is basically why we have believed in the Big Bang Theory. So this is the major prediction of Big Bang, and it's verified. Okay. Hand-wavingly. If you really want to verify it, you have to solve a bunch of Boltzmann-coupled equation numerically. But if you hand-wave enough, you can already say that it's incredible that the cosmology model that we're going to introduce, which is the basic one, will sort of give this prediction. It basically says that if you look at the universe and people can measure that how many hydrogen and how much helium are there. And the ratio is one part of helium, three parts hydrogen in mass. And this can be predicted. And it can also predict some other, whatever the next elements are, Li, H, heavy hydron, and even heavier hydron. And they can predict a bunch of numbers. And the basic idea of this one part helium, three parts hydrogen in mass can be predicted within one lecture with some hand waving. You have to believe in some numbers I throw at you. That seems to be tweaked. Then we can continue go back. Actually, now we are hot a little bit. It says that during all this time, there is something very mysterious. We also have absolutely no idea what it is. Has been actually pretty important during this time, which is dark matter. So, well, it's dark by definition. But then people realize that it's not just dark. It's just not like something we can't see. It's something that we actually have no idea. It's not made of a standard model particle. It's not made of nuclei and electrons. Let's put it that way. It's something mysterious. So we will say, why do we think they exist? There are evidence. There are all gravitational evidence because we have no idea what it is. What that means is that we haven't been able to produce it in collider, which, you know, LHC really tried to produce them. Or there are some gigantic, huge tank of material, maybe water, underneath the ground, try to capture some of them, and we have no luck so far. But we do believe it exists. So we will try to strengthen our belief, and then we'll do in a tutorial, which is something called a WIMP miracle. It says why that people believe this might be something. It's called the weakly interacting massive particles. Why do we believe that with many proposals, why that proposal is particularly popular? Okay, so now we're getting into the time that we really have no idea what happens. So now we go back and then there is something like QCD happens, so that the quarks and gluons are together now. And then the weak symmetry, electro weak symmetry that you guys are going to learn in the standard model will be restored. And then you go before that, nobody has no idea. And a major proposal is called inflation. Says that at the very beginning, this is very rough. Nobody knows what exactly the exponent is, but you can see it's very, very small fraction of a second. That it might be 32, 34, 36, who knows, 30. But at that, people proposed that the universe has actually expanded really, really rapidly. It's like exponentially expanding. So like every one unit of time, the universe doubles. And for as you can see, a very short period of time, but that the universe is grown by a factor of 10 to the 27 in that a very short period of time, at least. So the proposal is that. And we'll talk about why people propose such a crazy thing. Why do we need the universe to expand that much? That to fix some problems, like the very successful cosmology model, if that's all, then we are in some, we have a problem, we have puzzles. And the inflation is proposed to fix those puzzles. But nobody knows that it actually happens. And then, it's a very popular puzzle. It's a very popular proposal, especially that it connects to what we have talked so far. So remember, we need to have some sort of density, over-density region, such that they will form structures. So we need to exist somehow. If the universe is entirely homogeneous forever, we will certainly not exist. Like the average density of the universe is much, much, much lower than a human being. So we needed somewhere to have the initial fluctuations. And what is proposed by the inflation is that, well, let's say it's driven by some scalar field that you must be very fond of now, that it has some quantum fluctuations. And because the universe is expanding that fast, that it can be stretched to be classical fluctuation. And hopefully this fluctuation will grow under the self-gravity. And then we'll study at the end of the week precisely, suppose we have some fluctuation to begin with, how will they grow? When will they grow? This kind of things. And at the very end, we'll have a guest speaker, Angelica. And she will tell you about. So this is what I spent my entire PhD, my almost entire PhD on, is to study inflation. And I think it would be interesting to say what the other people think is that they don't believe in inflation. And I will spend some time to tell you why people, you know, have many criticisms about inflation. You can ask, actually, Neil Turok about it. But it'll be fun. We spend the last two lectures approximately to talk about a major alternative this picture might not be true. Well, actually, Neil changed his opinion recently. He says it's a nice toy model to play with, but it's probably not the truth. I think it's his opinion now. Okay, so here is our plan, is that we'll find the equations we're gonna use, and then we'll study the things that has been listed on that board. But at the beginning of all this, we shall know where we are now. So before I talk about the history of the universe, we're gonna talk about the history of observing the universe. So this happened in about last century. Since about 1900s, we start to observe the universe. So it turns from a philosophical subject into a science. We actually can do experiments. But you know, physics normally is experimental science. That it's nice, somebody does experiments and somebody else does it, and you know it doesn't depend on who did it. For cosmology, we are in a little bit of trouble. I think we're still having trouble to figure out how the nuclear fusion works, which means we can't make stars, and we can't make galaxies, smash them together, and see what happens. We have one universe, so there's no experiments, we're just observing what the universe gave us. But the first, very Ah, I see. Huh? Ah, I see. Okay, I don't think that a board moves, and there is another board doesn't move. Okay, no board moves. Okay, then let me use the half of this board. So what we're going to do first is the history of observations. And we'll make the first observation that you probably have heard, the cosmology is expensive. That we make a really huge satellite and keep the satellite running also costs a huge amount of money. But the very first observation you can make about the universe actually doesn't cost anything, and almost everybody can do it. And you probably do it almost every day. You just don't notice it's an observation of cosmology. So when, I guess, it's about 6. So tonight at 6, when you walk out some building and you look at the sky, and you realize at the night, the sky is dark. So we can go all the way back to Copernicus' era. That's what people realize, that although I'm sure that the people made that observation a long time ago. Actually, if you check the definition of night on dictionary, it tells us that night is the period of time that it's dark between one day and the next. So this is a confirmed observation by a lot of people. The question is, what kind of cosmology theory can we root out or, you know, can support from this observation? So let's make some calculation. Our calculation would be try to calculate exactly how dark the sky is, or how bright the sky is, and show that it's not that bright. So in the Copernicus era, Copernicus, you know, discovered that the Earth is not the center of the universe, then you realize that, well, we're not in the center of the solar system. The solar system is nowhere in the center of the galaxy, and then we realize, okay, let's just generalize that we're not in the center of the universe. But then they decided to have the first cosmological model. They also believe that so in that sense, the sun shouldn't be that different. So they have this model says all the other stars are just large growing spheres that just like the sun, but further than the sun, which is a very fair assumption. That's basically what a star is. So we have, then they claim that since we think we're not in the center of the universe is probably everywhere the same. So then you can make the following assumption, is that we have number of density of stars. And, you know, at that point, it's not a too bad approximation that each of the star has power of a star. And then they say they are evenly distributed around the infinite universe. Yeah, that's our first cosmological model. It looks kind of like this if I can keep them even. And then it goes forever. Yeah? So let's calculate what this cosmological model will tell us about the brightness of the sky. So we're going to measure the brightness of the sky by intensity, which is really the power received by our eye divided by area. You probably multiply the area of the eye and then figure out how much like light come in the eye. And then you register intensity and says, OK, That's the brightness of the sky. So this thing is definitely related to that. So let's do a calculation. For some, to make life easier, because there is this divided by area thing, so we're going to make some concentric spheres. So this distance is r, it's a sphere, might not look like one. And then there's this called dr. So we'll just figure out one of this shell, how much intensity I have. Then do an integration, then we'll be done, right? So this density in this shell, intensity in the shell, well, is given by the power. Let's just say started with one star over the area. Okay? And now we'll take into account of how many stars there. N is the number density, and 4 pi r squared, the r is the volume. Yeah? So if I take a shell like this, I'll get that much intensity. It's just using that definition, because we did one star, and this is how many stars there will be. Okay, things cancel out, isn't that nice? Well, in some sense. So now we're going to, as we proposed, says, let's just integrate it over. We have an infinite universe, so we integrate it over infinity. Well, this, of course, gave us infinity. Well, this is utterly nonsense. We certainly know that the intensity we receive by our I is not infinity. So what happened? Well, one thing you can think about immediately is that, no, definitely it's not infinity, because if you look in every direction, if you see a star, there will be stars behind that star, and those stars will be blocked by the first star you see. And if the universe is infinite in every direction, there will be a star. So this should have an upper bound of the brightness of a star, average star. So it's already not infinity, but it's not good enough, because we know that when we, well, otherwise there wouldn't be a song called a Twinkle Twinkle Little Star now that I sing every day, right? So that's definitely not good enough. And you can also say, well, we take this to be constant. Maybe there's some interesting thing going on. You know, the power is not a constant. Maybe it drops by 1 over r, like it decays. And well, that's, I don't know. I don't like that argument, because that violates the idea that we're not special. We're not in the center of the universe. So this thing should be somehow relatively the same everywhere. Well, the biggest thing that we got an infinity of the universe is probably because we integrated to infinity. That's normally where infinity comes from. If you integrate a finite thing over a range, is that you integrate to infinity. Okay, so then, well, you think that maybe the universe is not infinite. Who knows? But there is also a very interesting thing about whenever you talk about light, especially for cosmology. We know light travels very, very fast, so fast that we don't imagine that it's very relevant for our daily life. But in cosmology, it matters a lot. So because the light travels at a finite speed, so if the universe has a finite age, then that infinity would also change. We can only integrate it to the star that has enough time to send its light to us. So you can actually figure out the age of the universe, and you use that multiplied by c, speed of light, you get some number, you replace that infinity by that number. Indeed, you will get an intensity out, which is a billionth of the brightness of the sun, hence very dark. So we're actually going to explore the age of the universe quite a bit in our first tutorial. And that actually is one of the major clues we believe why dark energy exists. Without a dark energy, our prediction of the age of universe is sort of in tension with the oldest star people observe. Like we believe the age of the universe should be bigger than the oldest star. With dark matter, that order is preserved. Okay, so that's the first observation we make. What we establish from that observation is that should it be, say, age of universe times C, then that will happens to be dark. What we conclude is that such a universe proposed by the first people is flawed, at least in the way that the age of the universe should be finite. So now it brings us to 1900s. In 1900s, people began to measure something called a redshift. So basically, the idea is that if you look at a star or a galaxy, it will emit light, but before the light reaches us, they're going to be absorbed by some hydrogen atom in the atmosphere or something like that. So when we see a star's spectrum, there will be this absorption light. And if you compare this absorption lines with you can do such experiment with some emitting source folded by some hydrogen. You can do this experiment at home and in the lab. And you get a different a spectrum. What the people who have been observing this spectrum, the EM spectrum, and they compare absorption lines. They realize, okay, they're different. The ones we have in our lab and the ones they observe from different galaxies, they are all different. All the different galaxies, they are all different. So they say, let's define something. Well, actually, most of them are redshifted. So they're defining this symbol Z called a redshift, which measures the observed wavelengths and the emission wavelengths divided by emission wavelength. So observe, it's an O, or you can understand it as a zero. Normally, cosmologists are using zero to denote anything that happens today. Okay, if you observed 50 years ago in cosmology sense, it's still today. So that's just an interesting notation. Zero means today. So they observe these, they find their difference in the absorption lines. Then they say they take the difference, divide this very standard things to do. You want to compare the change with what it should be. And this thing is called the redshift. And it's called the redshift because the observed wavelength normally, most of the time, is bigger than the emission wavelengths. And hence, it's redder. Okay, so that's what they do. They do this things, redshift. And then, you know, people explain this with a standard Doppler effect. In 1900s, our observation strength is not that strong. So Z is of order something like 004, something like that. So you say, okay, that's not shifted by much. We're just going to use the non-relativistic Doppler effect. And Doppler effect says the frequency I observed is equals to the frequency emitted, and it's smaller because it's moving away from us. Right? This is what standard Doppler effect. Forget about its light because we're non-relativistic. So that's it's just a normal source moving away, and that's just the speed of the wave. You can think about throwing ping pong balls. Okay, so, well, let me flip this because the wavelength is really just the inverse of the frequency. With some 2 pi's we can throw away. So I'm just flipping this thing, and now I can stick the wavelength formula into the redshift formula. It tells us in the non-relativistic limit, redshift is just a matter of the speed. So if they compare their spectrum, they get a redshift, they immediately know how fast the galaxy is moving away from us. Okay, so this is how they measure speed. And then in 29, Hubble. So that's how they measure speed, and this method of Doppler shift is pretty good. And they also try to measure the distance of the galaxy. That method is slightly sloppy, and we can talk about why measuring distance is harder later. But the point is, Hubble collected 20 galaxies. So they measure the speed in kilometers per second. They measure distance in megaparsec. So parsec is, so this is Earth, this is the Sun, and then if they open a degree 1 second, this distance is parsec. Don't ask me why, but that's the most common distance unit in astronomy and cosmology. And megaparsec is about 3 × 10⁻⁹ kilometers, I think, this thing. I mean, it's useful because this is like sort of the how to measure distance between galaxies. But anyway, what Hubble did is just find some dot. There is a regional graph in the notes you can go to say. The point is it's a bunch of scattered dots. And Hubble saw a line through it. See, when you want to use linear regression, you are always able to do it. And that's what Hubble told me. You just do it. And he claimed that there is a line through it and I can measure the slope. So there is velocity, and there is the speed, the distance, and then there is this Hubble constant. Which is defined by V over D. So this is crazy and it has an unit. Unit is kilometer per second over megaparsec, literally a slope of that graph. And the number is about 70. 73, 70. It's a number that we keep measuring. It's definitely not as well measured as other numbers just because the distance are hard to measure. So the point is, if you look at this crazy, crazy unit, you can say, come on, it's a speed divided by distance. So the unit should just be 1/time. So you can totally write Hubble constant with the unit of time. This is all very approximate, but it's 14 billion years. Which is interesting, because we can make such an assumption. The assumption is that suppose we have a galaxy, and suppose they are doing the easiest motion we studied in Newton's first law. They are just doing constant velocity. The galaxy, somehow we assume this galaxy's velocity never have changed. And then that number says 14 billion years ago that a galaxy should be colliding to us. So it seems this big bun thing, everything, all the galaxies will move together. And things seems to naturally imply a Big Bang theory. And this is about the same time as our age of universe. But of course, we did some crazy assumption. We assume that all the galaxies keep their velocity the whole time of the age of the universe, which is definitely conflicting with Hubble's law. And then in the tutorial on Wednesday, we're going to explore, actually, if we do a more accurate estimate, we'll find our universe is much younger, so young that it's younger than some of those old stars out there. And that's where the cosmology constant comes in. Says, let's add that, and if you study the evolution of the universe, you finally bring the age to be about that. Okay, so this is the second observation we made. So maybe this will revive the idea of maybe we are in the center of the universe after all. Look, all the galaxies are flying away from us. How could that happen? So if you have a balloon and you can make some dots on it, and if you blow the balloon up, and you will realize all the dots are flying away from each other, so you can consider every point as the center of the universe and all the dots are flying away from it. And you can also, if you bake chocolate chip cookies, and when you stick them into the oven, as it expands in the oven, and all the chocolate chips would also move away from each other, and now them are considered to be the center of the universe. Okay, so there is no center of the universe, and the universe, we have this cosmological principle named after Copernicus, is that basically says the universe is the same wherever we are and whoever we are. And it says the universe is large scale, homogeneous and isotropic. So, well, isotropic is for a free-falling observer. These are all on very large scale sense. For example, that say suppose the floor suddenly crack, then I'll become a free-falling observer. And the Earth definitely defines a direction for me, so not isotropic. And if you're in a solar system, the sun definitely defines a direction that is not isotropic. You just have to go large scales. So this happens around 100 megaparsec. And you realize that at 100 megaparsec, the universe starts to have no preferred direction, and it also starts to be homogeneous. It's also not homogeneous in small scale. A sphere centered around me will contain a human being. The next sphere next to me will contain air. The density difference about 10 to the 3, I think. But if you go far to be sphere of radius of 100 megaparsec, you can find still many of such spheres in the universe. Then the density will be approximately the same, and there's no preferred direction, and this has been measured. Crazy enough. So the next measurement, we're down to 1964. Oh, this is embarrassing because I can't remember these two important people's name, Pearsall and Wilson. Pearsall and Wilson, let me spell their name right. So they are the discoverer of CMB that win the Nobel Prize. And apparently if you have one of the really old non-digital TV and if you turn it on, and there are some snowflakes, I think about less than 1%, but non-zero part of those snowflakes, observation of CMB. But these guys, they are doing some completely different experiment. They are observing things in the radio wave, and they find this noise. This really annoyed the noise that is 100 times above what they plan to observe. And they did everything. They clean up their equipment and trying to figure out all the system errors. They find out their telescope is way too big, so there are pigeons in there and they have nests. So they removed the pigeon nests. And something they called it the Ural-Wyatt dialect. They are dielectric. Out of those telescopes, they tried again, the noise is still there. And 60 kilometers away from them, there are people says, wait, we have this Big Bang theory. We think that we can predict the universe, the Big Bang has blasted a huge amount of radiation, and if this all this radiation has been propagating through the age of the universe, I get a redshifted, it should be about the same you observe. So they were very cautious, published the entire paper, just what they observe, and at the very end, there's a footnote that says it might be related to cosmology. But they won the Nobel Prize. And ever since then, that's from 1964 onward, that's all what we do about most of majority of the things we do about observing cosmology is about this, because this let us look back all the way to 380,000 years, which is when universe is very young. And then there's COBE satellite. Okay. Something like Cosmic Background Explorer. And then there's WMAP. I think it's Wilson Microwave and Anisotropic Probe. And then there's Planck, yes. I don't have to remember the name for Planck. There is just lots of satellites, and then before that there are lots of balloons. But they keep marrying it. Even the first one says the universe has a temperature of that, plus minus some small fluctuation. So this is, means that if you measure all this light from different direction, and that it is a, it's a perfect, it's the best black body spectrum we can ever imagine. The universe is such a black body with a temperature this. And as you see, this is a very strong support for the idea that the large universe in the large scale is homogeneous and isotropic. And actually, when they do the experiment, they will find some dipole, like half of the sky is slightly hotter than the other half, that's because the Earth is moving. Like the Earth is moving and then the whole, if you subtract all the things about our local galaxy, it's almost perfect. And then WMAP measured that the delta T over T is 10 to the minus 5 K. So that you can actually, 10 to the minus 5. So you actually have inhomogeneous, which is good because the structure, the formation needs that. So there is the seed. Well, let's see, this is this is like the saplings that will grow into the trees today. And ever since that, we will keep observing the universe. Okay, so now we're today. So we're done with what we have observed. So now we're going to do the first thing we say on the list is to write down the metric and the equation of motion for the universe. Okay, the idea is that we are really going to stick with our cosmological principles as it's homogeneous and isotropic, which means let's just focus on the space of universe. In the homogeneous isotropic universe, we're able to find an observer such that at any time, the space of the universe should also be homogeneous and isotropic. And let's use DL, reserving DS for the one has the. Okay, so for the homogeneous universe, that since it's a homogeneous, so I expect I will be able to find the Ricci scalar to be everywhere the same. Curvature should be the same everywhere. Hence, I can have the classification of the universe being it's a constant bigger than zero, constant equals than zero, constant smaller than zero. This I know exactly it is. It's my flat space, and it's Euclidean. Excellent. So I only need to deal with the other case. A space that has positive curvature is things we all know, like the surface of Earth is a space of positive curvature. So basically, we just need to find a three sphere instead of a two sphere. Okay, how do we find the three sphere? Is we say that we're gonna try to embed it. So this is a flat three space, and then now we have a flat four space. So that's exactly how you study how you embed the surface of the Earth. You can embed it in a three-dimensional space. Now we're gonna do a same, that we have a three sphere, we're gonna embed it in a four dimensions with some embedding equation, this. That's the definition of the sphere, is that it's the same radius from a certain point. So now we're just going to do some scaling with this scaling, this metric have this radius A is outside. What it has is this. So the only thing we need to do is to get this rid of this dimension. So now we have x1, x2, x3, u, four quarter coordinate. If we want to find a metric on the three sphere, we need to get rid of one. which let's choose to be that one. So we're going to do derivative of that. Yeah? So this will give me du square is equals to u square x dx square, which I can plug in here. And I'm going to the embedding equation after the scaling is just 1. So I'm going to replace this by 1 minus x squared. OK, the next thing to do is I'm going to go to the sphere coordinate so that this become dr square plus the omega square, and this term become 1 minus r square dr square. So that's coming from x square is equals r square. Again, you do this cute making a derivative thing. And you can combine them to get so the main idea is you start with this metric, you just try to get rid of the du square. And I might have gone through this calculation too fast, but you can do the same calculation with the one that has constant negative curvature. The changes are a bunch of minus signs. So instead of this, there's a minus sign here. So if you did the calculation, just try to follow this step, except with those three minus signs carried through, you discover a change sign in your final metric. And that's it. That's the only effect of the curvature of the space, which manifests in that metric as a plus minus one. I do encourage to do this calculation on yourself once, because that is our metric of the universe. That's the first very important calculation, I think. Oh, I think you are going to do something that's also some calculation I proposed for your homework, is instead of study the maximum symmetric space, you are going to study the maximally symmetric space time. And then you can discover entity sitter, de sitter, and all those cool stuff. OK, so then people like to write it in a way that is everything combined together. They propose this k thing. And the one k is positive 1, it's positive curvature. K minus 1 is minus 1 curvature. Curvature and the k equals 0, it's flat. So next time, equipped with the knowledge of the space, maximally symmetric to space that has a constant curvature, we're just going to add the time component, and that is the FLRW metric. That's the metric of the universe. And with the metric of the universe, we're just going to study the galaxies or photons moving in it. It's like you have a metric. Let's study the geodesic of things. And then we'll write down the equation of motion of the universe. It's like the F equals ma. So that's the plan tomorrow. But the homework will be post. First question is really a very similar calculation to this. So you should be able to do. The second question, we have to wait until tomorrow. OK, we're done.